This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba, through the hour, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice, and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Here's our toll-free number if you'd like to talk with Zorba. 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, along with the calls, always some research to kick around.
Yes, we're going to talk about your political leanings and how it may affect your brain. Left wing, right wing, left brain, right brain. We'll talk about some interesting
results. So we have brain differences among people. Okay, what else?
Right, which side are you on, and what does that mean for your brain? And health risks, whether or not we should charge workers more money for poor health habits.
Oh, that's interesting and controversial.
You bet it's controversial.
And we have a listener recipe coming up.
Oh, it's great. Coconut chicken with peanut saute.
This one from Germania, Pennsylvania listener Allison Arbeiter. That's coming up in, about 25 minutes or so. A medical myth buster as well. You'll want to stay tuned here to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Zorba, a listener with us now in Cedar City, Utah. Hi.
Hello. How are you, Tom?
Good. How can we help you?
Good. Listen, I am, Dr. Zorba, a swimmer, and I had been training for a competition, a swimming competition, 400-meter freestyle, and I thought, okay, no problem. I only had a couple days to train for it. I trained for it, swam, won the bronze medal.
Wow. Oh, you won the bronze medal.
I know it's kind of scary, but true, especially as old as I am, but when I got done with it, I thought, you know, I've really got to take some time off of my swimming. So I really started pushing and started developing some pain in my shoulders.
Oh, okay.
And actually in both shoulders. And it just seems to get worse and worse and worse. I took some ibuprofen for about a month, three times during the day to kind of keep it in my system to try to see if the swelling would go down. It didn't seem to make a lot of difference, and I'm wondering what I might be able to do to help so I can continue to swim.
Yeah, of course.
So we're clear, at least so I'm clear, that you think the shoulder problems were caused by the swimming, right?
Absolutely. Yeah,
okay.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you go in, you're in the pool, the pain gets worse. When you don't swim for a couple of days, the pain gets better.
It seems to subside, but it's interesting because even when I lay in my bed, if I lay on my shoulders, I can feel it.
Wow, that must be uncomfortable for
you. Yeah, yeah. So I end up on my back. My wife hates it because I snore then, and you know.
Then you've got the family problems.
That's right. It's just not good all the way around.
Snoring fixes shoulder. I love it.
That's right.
Now, what about if you put your hands on your side and you do a jumping jack, you know, where the hands go up? Do you have can you do that and lift your arm above your head?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Well, a couple of recommendations. First of all, inevitably you're not going to have to give up swimming, but
I hope not.
I would recommend 2 Aleve tablets twice a day. The reason is it lasts for 12 hours, and I would do that automatically for 6 weeks. Automatically.
Okay.
That is the anti-inflammatory dose of naproxen. And what you want to do is you need to have that anti-inflammatory dose really on level for about 3 to 6 weeks. So I always tell people, if you're going to do it for 6 weeks. Don't take it for the analgesic effect. Take it for the anti-inflammatory effect. Second thing is gentle range of motion activities. Go to the web, Google the word ROM, which means range of motion, shoulder activities. You'll find a whole bunch of websites. Pick a university or a college or medical center website, and you will see great information on the web. There'll be videos. There'll be hard copy that you can go down, and you do gentle range of motion activities. The final thing is, if that doesn't work after 2 weeks, call up your doc, say you want a physical therapy consult, and what you do is they have these rubber bands. And they're not really rubber bands, and you work isometrically against the rubber bands to build up the strength in the muscle, and that's what it is. It's strength on one side, range of motion on the other.
I was wondering whether you're going to say see a doc, because is there any chance that there may be a shoulder injury?
Well,
do you think?
Good point. Yeah, you know, there may be a shoulder injury that actually needs to have a physician or needs to have some sort of a scope in there. But the first thing we do is treat conservatively.
Now let me make sure it's ROM shoulder activities.
Well, you write down range of motion. ROM is just the it's just the acronym for range of motion. So you write range of motion or ROM, shoulder exercise, and you'll pop up a bunch of websites. Google is a great way to gather medical information, but a trusted site is a medical site that you know of.
Mm-hmm.
Not something like, Fred Smith's website.
No. Definitely.
And thanks a lot. We appreciate the call. And listener, if your name is Fred Smith, don't take it out on Zorba. He didn't mean you specifically. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Speaking of swimming, Zorba, let's grab a question from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This email is signed Nervous in the Water. It reads, "Dear Zorba, do you have any advice for an adult who has been struggling to learn to swim for many years? I desperately want to be able to enjoy the water with my family and have taken years of swim lessons, but I still can't get over this irrational fear."
Well, the answer is yes, I do have some suggestions because I had a very similar situation. I mean, I had an awful situation learning how to swim, and I succeeded. And I'll tell you what I've done, and then I've looked at research, and it's really the same. First of all, my dad, God bless him, may he rest in peace, his idea of learning how to swim was walking out with me, I remember this, into Lake Michigan in Chicago and saying, "Okay, learn to swim," and throwing me in the water.
Yeah. That's done. I know.
Just throw them in the water and they'll learn how to swim like a dog, and they'll learn to swim. Yeah. And I remember coughing and sputtering, and he did it, once, and then he brought me again. And finally, I just screamed and yelled, and my mother finally said, "Arch, you're not going to do that." And that was it. My mother never raised her voice, but when she did, my father paid attention. Mm-hmm. And then for years, I'd have nightmares, a recurring nightmare, that I would fall and trip into a puddle and drown.
Oh, my goodness.
A puddle of water.
Yeah.
And I still occasionally get that nightmare, even in my, I'm 39.
So
even now that I'm 39.
Not 39.
I still get that.
So what'd you do?
I've been 39 for years. Well, what I did was I took lessons for the terrified. And there are lessons that you get. There are specialized lessons. You have to find out in your area if they have them. If not, you want to learn how to swim, you travel 50 to 100 miles away, and you take lessons for the terrified. There are certified instructors that have techniques of teaching people who are terrified. And believe me, the terrified, being terrified are things like standing up in water and putting your face in the water.
Mm-hmm.
They're very, very simple, logical steps. Now, for me, I go whitewater rafting. I have a pool in my backyard.
Mm-hmm.
I go swimming with others. Am I comfortable in the water? I tolerate it.
Oh,
I do it because I want to be
still
with
not really
them. Absolutely. I have a diving board. The only way I can dive is off the side, jumping in the water with my feet down. I never dive at all. But my son said, I've had this pool for 15 years at our house, and I was talking to my son. He said, "Dad, you never jumped off the diving board. The diving board is 4 feet above." Not even 4 feet, probably 3 feet
above
the other part.
Yeah.
When I stand out on the end of the diving board, I can't do it.
Yeah.
I can do it off the side. Now, I can go whitewater rafting, and I can be underwater with that, which I don't particularly like, but I still go rafting.
Yeah.
It's a very odd thing. So what you have to do is you have to work on it. Everyone can learn to swim if they work hard enough and they have a good instructor.
Yeah, and get a specialized person who works for the people who
it's
are
called
terrified.
Swimming for the Terrified. Google the name. YMCA will know of people. Do not take an adult swim class. That doesn't work. You have to have individual, private learning with a certified instructor, and it will work.
Well, you'll never have to fear about sending us your questions. Just send them in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Want to talk with Zorba? Call 800-462-7413. And Zorba, listener with us now in Memphis, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
First of all, let me say it's my pleasure to be on the show. I listen to the show quite regularly, and I'm excited that I get to actually ask a question of Dr. Zorba.
Well, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you. Thanks for the comment.
How can we help you?
Well, I'm 56 years old, and just in the last 3 weeks, I was diagnosed with a kidney stone.
Hmm.
And the kidney stone apparently has been there for quite some time because it's about the size of a nickel. I'm going to have the first lipotropsy done tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, what can I do diet-wise to prevent having to go through this in the future, because this is extremely painful.
Oh, yeah, kidney stones are awful, and they affect about 1 to 2% of the population. So, I mean, they really do affect people. And by the way, the what you're going to have, lithotripsy, is not a common word in the American vernacular, but basically these are sound waves. You're in a tub, and there's sound waves that basically take a big stone and break it up into gravel so that you can pass it. And it really works beautifully. There are lots of people who no longer have to have surgery to remove their kidney stone. Well, what we do is, first thing, we look at the stone and make sure it's not a uric acid stone. Uric acid is something we can fix. We give you a drug called allopurinol. 90% of the people never make the stones, and life is good. But a uric acid stone is the rare stone. It is not the common stone. 97% of the stones, approximately, are calcium stones. And frankly, we don't know how to keep them from happening. You know, we've got advice.
We can't do any diet corrections?
No. One advice is make sure you're hydrated. You're not dehydrated, because you're more likely to form stones. There's no evidence that limiting your calcium limits the risk that you have a calcium stone. And frankly, that's not good for your bones. There's no calcium that you can get rid of. And those are basically the things. Some people believe that there is a diuretic called hydrochlorothiazide that may reduce the chances that you will have a stone. But frankly, there ain't nothing you can do. Now, I had a kidney stone about 10, 12 years ago, and for a while, I looked through the literature all the time, because I don't want to get another one. One a lifetime is enough. You don't need two. But I discovered, for instance, trying to drink when I'm not thirsty is not a, you know, was very tough to do. And the fact is, as long as you, especially in the summer, when it's hot, when you're exercising, as long as you pay attention to your water intake, that's the best advice that I can give you.
Let me ask you, are you an optimist or a pessimist?
I'm an optimist.
Yeah, where does Zorba, that come from?
Wait, you're an optimist, Zorba.
Absolutely.
You two have had kidney stones. I'm a pessimist, and I haven't had a kidney. So that survey proves that, be a pessimist, and you won't get a,
you
kidney
stone.
You got it,
Tom. You're on to something, baby.
Oh, I just need to change my way of thinking. I've seen
That's
it.
Right. That's right.
Well, my urologist told me I was lucky that my stone was so big, and I said, thank you. I was thinking myself really unlucky. Let me just change my perspective. Well, thank you, Tom. I'll have to change my perspective once again.
Yep. Well, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. I'll see her soon in Memphis.
Thanks for the call.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. That's 800-462-7413. You mentioned Zorba research on political leanings and the brain. Let me guess. Liberal brains are a little bit larger than conservative brains.
I don't think so.
That isn't the research?
So. Oh. I don't think so.
All right, well, tell us about
it. Now, you know, some people would think that conservative brains are larger than liberal brains.
You think so?
Yeah,
anybody would think that?
Or maybe other people think that the conservative brain is more organized than the liberal.
Well, some of us wouldn't
argue
with
that. The liberal brain has more tangles.
Anyway, what's this research
about?
Well,
they were looking, actually, at people who label themselves staunch conservatives and people who label themselves staunch liberals.
Right.
And then they were placed in front of a computer screen. It's just the brain processes information differently. And, you know, the thought is that conservatives are more structured and more persistent in making decisions, and liberals are more open to new experiences. And, you know, obviously these are stereotypes.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, there's no truth in that at
all. None at all. Not a bit.
But then they had two different letters that appeared on the screen. I found their choice of letters rather interesting that people had to respond to. It was the letter M.
All right.
Or the letter W.
W. Okay.
Now, why they didn't choose the letter like K and the letter Q, I don't know. But they chose the letter M and the letter W.
Well,
And 80% of the time, and every time there was a letter, you were supposed to hit a button, okay? Okay. So 80% of the time in front of the screen, the letter M, you were supposed to hit a button. And then there were times that you weren't supposed to hit the button. And the W button, when the W was there, you weren't supposed to hit the button.
Oh, okay.
So what they found was the letter M that appeared all the time was very easy to get in the habit. You saw the M, you hit the button, saw the M, hit the button, saw the M, hit the button. But then you saw the W, you're not supposed to hit the button. And the question was, who was more likely to hold back from hitting the button? The liberals or the conservatives?
The liberals.
Right. because they were used to a change in the way things were, and the conservatives were stuck, and they haven't. And that proves that it's brain power that separates
them. The MW thing is really a faulty tool to use.
Really? Do you think so? Now, why? Why would you possibly think
that? I don't have to explain it. This is a bad study.
All right. That's it. Fake science again. All right. It's tossed.
Out it goes. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Marshfield, Wisconsin. Hi.
How are you gentlemen doing today?
We're fine. How can we help you?
Well, I was watching daytime TV a couple of days ago, which was probably my first problem.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not going to say the name of the show, but they were doing...
tell us the show. Come on.
It was all that Montel guy. I don't really know.
Oh, come on.
Montel.
No, seriously.
Montel.
Yeah, I feel bad if I actually knew the last name.
Yeah.
But they're talking about the anthrax shot. Now, when I was when I first joined the military in 99, my first duty station was a little island off Saudi Arabia. And so I was initially, you know, right then I had my first set of anthrax shots, and I received the whole series over the next 5 years. And they're talking about people having health problems with it. And now I've never experienced anything myself, I don't think, and I trust our government. But I was just wondering if there's been any research done on it.
Oh, sure. Now, the thing about immunizations is that whenever we get a shot, we worry about it more than a pill. That's a psychological issue. I get a shot in my body, I'm worried it may cause me problems, where if I take a pill for anthrax, it doesn't bother people nearly as much. So, and that's a psychological issue. That's not, has nothing to do with scientific.
That is true.
I get a shot, I worry about it, I got the shot for this, I got sick. If you took a pill and you got sick, you say, well, it doesn't bother you as much. There's a psychological issue, nothing to do with reality. The anthrax shots do not appear to have any long-term consequences now, as we speak. In other words, it doesn't appear to be that way. Now, all immunizations tend to be attacked by trial lawyers. They just attack them because they're good money. So they attack measles and mumps and German measles and pertussis, and they always attack immunizations as causing side effects because there's good money in that, and juries believe that psychologically.
With class action lawsuits.
And individual lawsuits, and they'll say there's, you know, the anthrax immunizations, and that's money. There's nothing whatsoever to do with power, with science. The scientific evidence as we speak now is that the anthrax immunization is fair. In other words, it's not really great. We need a better anthrax immunization, which is what they're working on, because it's not that effective. It's only, I think, 40 or 50% effective against anthrax. But the side effect profile is the same as with tetanus, you know, which is a very acceptable immunization because it's been around for 100 years. So on the whole, I think you're safe. You pay attention to the science. The best website for this is cdc.gov, the Centers for Disease Control .gov, or the nih.gov. They will give you good scientific information, which is not overlaid with the politics that, like you said, I mean, you knew it was political because the first thing you said was, I trust my government. In other words, you wanted to get that away from there. And I trust individual people, but I certainly trust scientists.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good luck, and good luck on watching Montel.
Yeah. Not on a regular basis. Thanks a lot for the call. Well, we have our recipe coming up next. We have our medical myth buster coming up a little bit later. Lots more of your calls, too. So good to have you along with us this time here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. The number to call if you'd like to talk with Zorba, 800-462-7413. But right now, Zorba, recipe time. This one from a listener in Germania, Pennsylvania, Allison Arbeiter. Allison, hi.
Hi, Tom.
Good to have you with us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Now, the recipe is coconut chicken with peanut satay. And let me say, I've been doing this show for a gazillion years with Zorba, and we've had recipes with the word satay in them. I've never asked Zorba, Allison, what in the heck is satay?
A peanut sauce.
Oh, it's always a peanut sauce.
Mm-hmm. Thai or Indonesian peanut sauce.
Why don't they say peanut sauce?
Because they're Indonesian or they're Thai. You know, peanut sauce is English.
Okay.
You know, it can't be totally ethnocentric. That's it.
Okay. Well, how'd you come up with this one?
Well, I'm a hobby chef, a foodie, really, and I love to create new dishes.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband is Dutch, and Indonesian food is popular in the Netherlands. So when I visited the Netherlands, I learned about Indonesian food and loved it. And then it turned out that I became allergic to certain foods.
Mm-hmm.
Wheat gluten was my primary problem, and I was faced with discovering new ways to prepare our traditional foods that we liked, but without wheat. And of course, I wanted to keep them really healthy. So to give extra flavor and kind of protect the delicate surface of chicken or fish, traditionally, people use flour or breadcrumbs,
mm-hmm.
and I had to come up with a new breadcrumb. So I started using organic dehydrated potato flakes and brown rice flour and even coconut in place of breadcrumbs.
Huh. And your husband likes this recipe?
This is actually probably his favorite, if not one of his favorites.
Really?
Wow, wow. Well, I too am a foodie. I too am a foodie, and I love experimenting with things. And when I looked at this recipe, I thought, coconut? Why are you using coconut in this? But now I understand what you were doing in terms of looking for a taste. And, of course, you know, coconut is widely used in Indonesia and Thailand, and it's a major food source, and so it's used in lots of different ways.
Allison, you've got a whole bunch of stuff in here, and as Zorba and I go through the ingredients, you butt in and expand on or elaborate on as we go along, okay?
Yeah, please do that. And as you say, the Dutch love Indonesian food. The best Indonesian food I've ever had in my life was in Holland. It was in Indonesia, where they have very good Indonesian food, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, so we start out with 1 pound of boneless, skinless chicken breasts, which are thinly sliced.
This feeds how many, Allison?
It can be 4 to 6, or you can even make it an appetizer if you were having a party.
Oh, okay.
Oh, that would sound good.
Okay, start out with 1 pound of chicken breast, boneless, skinless, and sliced thinly.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So now, and I've got a question. It's 1/2 cup of coconut shredded sweetened and 1/2 cup of coconut shredded unsweetened. How'd you come up with that?
Well, the first time that I tried it, I used all sweetened coconut, and I felt that it was just too sweet, and I wanted to try to add a little more savory flavor.
Isn't coconut kind of sweet anyway? I didn't even know there was a sweetened coconut.
Most coconut in the baking aisle is sweetened.
Huh.
But notice what she said, in the baking aisle, because we associate coconut with sweetness because we associate it with dessert.
Cake.
And,
right.
And cake.
Right.
And it's the same, by the way, with pumpkin, because one of our favorite recipes at home is pumpkin soup, and people go, pumpkin soup? Because they only associate pumpkin with pumpkin
but
pie.
But if you're in Hawaii and you crack a coconut and drink the stuff, it's sweet.
Yeah, it has sweetness to it. It has a little bit of sweetness. But it doesn't have a lot of sweetness by comparison.
Okay,
yes, it is sweet.
Let's continue.
2 egg whites beaten.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
2 egg whites beaten.
Yolk is out, therefore... The yolk is out. I didn't mean that really as a pun. But I'll take it. But therefore, you don't have the cholesterol in there, which is excellent.
Right.
A pinch of salt. A
little salt.
4 tablespoonfuls of natural peanut butter. So this is organic peanut butter that you get?
I do usually get organic peanut butter, and this way it doesn't have any trans fats. It doesn't have any fat added to
it. Excellent point. Right. No trans fats. You can now go down the aisle and find peanut butter without trans fats, but trans fats are what keep it from getting rancid. And, of course, peanut butter, which is not natural usually, is peanut butter that has sugar added to it. A tablespoonful of chicken stock, fat-free.
A big tea. Chicken stock, fat-free.
Mm-hmm. You may need to add more chicken stock depending on the thickness of your peanut butter.
Got you. So, in other words, the chicken stock is what you use to find the consistency of what you have. So,
that's correct.
Which
mm-hmm.
is excellent. And I usually use chicken stock in a box because then it has these little boxes. I don't have to open up a whole can, and I can use just as much as I need.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Cooks Illustrated, which is my favorite cooking magazine, has said the box chicken stock actually is better tasting than the canned.
That's my favorite cooking magazine.
Yeah, right. Yeah, your favorite cookbook is called The Menu.
Right.
That's
right.
Your favorite cookbook,
okay,
The Menu.
Okay, let's go.
A teaspoon of toasted sesame oil.
A little tea, toasted sesame oil.
A tablespoonful of wheat-free tamari sauce. Why do you use wheat-free tamari soy sauce?
Well, I am gluten intolerant,
and
I cannot eat any wheat.
Right.
And it can be substituted with regular soy sauce for people who can have soy sauce.
I must tell you, I did not know that soy sauce had wheat in it when it was made.
Yes,
I mean, it's made
with
soybeans. I had no idea at all until now. Teaspoon of lemon juice.
A little tea lemon juice.
Quarter teaspoon of Tabasco or sambal.
A quarter little tea. What is sambal?
Sambal is an Indonesian chili paste.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite hot, very thick, and very fiery. It's the whole chilies, and they're mixed with a little tiny bit of oil.
You see, Tom likes
hot
stuff.
Fiery is good.
Tom would like some sambal.
Yeah. Tom, I'm in your company. I love hot food.
Is sambal. Quarter teaspoon of Indonesian fish sauce.
Quarter little tea Indonesian fish sauce.
Right, and you can buy fish sauce in addition to Asian grocery
stores. What is that? I mean,
Fish sauce, it's salty, it's made from fish, and you can pretty much get it in big grocery stores these days.
Okay.
The fish sauce is very important to the dish because this is what gives the dish umami. And I don't know if you're familiar with umami, but most of us are familiar with the four tastes, sweet, sour, salty, and bitter.
Mm-hmm.
And umami in Japan is called the fifth flavor, and it's often described as a savory taste. And it's the natural glutamates that are found in foods such as tomatoes or mushrooms. And fish sauce contains umami, and it's really what gives the dish it's really a good punch. It's delicious.
Good punch.
That's really interesting.
So, good Indonesian fish sauce. Teaspoon of honey.
Little tea honey.
Quarter teaspoon of ground cumin.
Quarter little tea ground cumin.
And a quarter teaspoon of ground coriander.
Quarter little tea ground coriander.
So let's put it together. First, preheat the oven to 350 degrees. Cut the chicken into strips. Place the coconut in a food processor. Chop briefly. Then line a cookie sheet with nonstick foil, or you could take regular foil and spray some nonstick spray. Spread the coconut across the baking sheet in a single layer. Bake for about 7 to 10 minutes until lightly toasted. Remove from the oven and place in a shallow dish. So this is what you're using to bread the chicken.
That's right.
That's great. Then increase the oven to 450 degrees. Beat the egg whites with a pinch of salt. Dip the chicken strips into the egg whites and then into the toasted coconut. Place the chicken on the baking sheet lined with the nonstick foil or the spray and bake for 10 minutes. Then turn, bake it an additional 5 minutes until done. Great idea. Then whisk together the peanut butter, chicken stock, little more if you want it thinner, sesame oil, tamari sauce, lemon juice, sambal, that nice hot stuff, fish sauce, honey, cumin, and coriander. Divide it into six dishes, then divide the chicken into six portions and serve with a small dish of peanut satay. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you.
The most interesting recipe we've ever had, and did our producer, Adam Friedrich, take the time to put this together for us so that we could eat it? The answer is...
Moi.
No. Absolutely no. I don't know what's... Adam brings us every boring thing under the sun that we have for a recipe. As soon as we got an exciting one...
Done. It's not there. It's not there.
Thank you so much, Allison, for submitting this one. We really do appreciate it.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me on the show.
Good talking with you.
Very good talking with you.
For sending us this winning recipe, Allison gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low-Fat, Guilt-Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's easy. Just email your original low-fat recipe to us at...
Zorba@WPR.org.
For today's recipe, send a stamped, self-addressed, business-sized envelope to... Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706.
And if you want this recipe to go, just go to our website. You can sign up for our weekly recipe podcast and search all your favorite Zorba Pastor on Your Health recipes. That's zorbapastor.org.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And Zorba, a listener with us now in High Bridge, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello, Tom and Zorba. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Thanks for calling. What's up?
Well, my mouth is still watering over that recipe.
Yeah,
but
no kidding.
I'll try to talk here. Recently, as a part of my annual physical, I got a complete blood test. And as I was reviewing the results with my doctor, I was really taken aback by the number of numbers for the liver. I mean, there's, you know, a few readings for cholesterol, and then there was, you know, five or six different measurements for the liver. And I had never quite realized the complexity of the liver. And I started thinking of how I eat certain things for heart health or bone health, but I've never consciously eaten for liver health. So my question for you, Zorba, is, what do you recommend in the way of mineral supplements, herbal supplements, or dietary choices to support healthy liver function?
You bring up an interesting point. Here it is. We eat the right way to reduce our cholesterol, to mm-hmm. keep our heart going.
Mm-hmm.
And then we try to make sure we have calcium for the bones.
Mm-hmm.
Who's watching the liver?
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Who's looking at the liver? And if we look back before circulation was discovered, the liver, which is from the word live, obviously, was filled with so much blood that people thought the liver was the source of blood in the
mm-hmm.
body because it was so filled with blood and it was essential to life. The number one thing with liver is avoid excessive alcohol. That's number one. If we look at liver failure, we look at cirrhosis, that's the number one way that we keep track of the liver. 1 to 2 drinks a day is fine. More than 2 drinks a day, you run a risk. Making sure you don't have certain poisons in your body and toxins such as heavy metals, which are detoxified by the liver. These are things that damage the liver. Those are kind of the things that you look at. But I don't know of anything that, quote, promotes liver health, but certainly if you could wrap something up in a pill and give it a nice nifty label, you too can make your $100 million this year by promotes liver health, because the FDA will allow you to say promotes liver health. In other words, they'll allow you to say it. You can claim anything you want to and make a vitamin and say, good for your liver. You just have to sell the American population on buying the liver vitamin. But I don't have anything that actually is good for the liver.
Well, you did. You the stuff you said was
well,
really
I know
good.
What isn't bad for the liver. That's kind of what it is. Your liver is a great organ, and
mm-hmm.
frankly, it's big. It does a lot of stuff. You only need about half of it. You've got twice as much liver in your body as you need, because people who share some of their liver with their relative in terms of liver transplants mm-hmm. know they have enough, and the liver can regenerate well within an environment of that. The other thing that you can do is that you don't become obese. Obesity can produce something called fatty infiltration of the liver, which then increases liver enzymes. And there's no evidence that it causes liver problems, but it increases these liver enzymes that 20 or 30 years down the line, we don't know, because 2/3 of America now is overweight.
Okay.
So good luck to you.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate being on your show, Zorba.
We appreciate having you.
Thank you so much. We appreciate the call at 1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. Before we go to the break, Zorba, it's time for another case for Judge Zorba. Although this case might be a bit outside of your jurisdiction, this dispute comes to us from Sabina in Linz, Austria. She writes, Dear Zorba and Tom.
In Austria?
Austria.
I didn't realize.
The signal goes a long way. I think maybe the computer has something to do with it.
Maybe that has something to do with it.
She writes, Dear Zorba and Tom, my husband and I are very conscious of what we eat. However, we've become entangled in a dispute. My husband says that eating at least one warm meal a day is necessary to remain fit and healthy. I say that warm food is great, but it's not unhealthy to go a few days without a warm meal. Who's right?
I don't think you need to have a warm meal every day.
Yeah.
I don't think so at all. I don't think there's any evidence that warm food is better for you than cold food. I think there's evidence that you should cook things that need to be cooked. You know, meat, fish, those things need to be cooked. But veggies certainly don't have to be cooked, and fruits don't have to be cooked either. So there's no evidence in that. I think it's a cultural issue, and you have to pay attention to those cultural issues, and you have to say, look, I don't feel good unless I have a warm meal every day. It makes me feel better. Hey, who's to argue with that? That's a cultural issue. You feel better. But from a point of view, there are a lot of people who don't eat warm food every day, and they're healthy.
Can you think of any food
which, when warmed, becomes healthier?
Meat. You can't eat meat cold. You have to cook. You have to cook.
Well,
meat.
No, I mean any food that you would ordinarily.
Oh, you mean you
cook.
Improve the health
like
by
if you
warming
have a
it
carrot,
up.
If you have a carrot and you eat it raw and you put it and you cook it, it doesn't
well,
get any healthier.
Well, actually, gets less healthy if you
yeah, that's
cook
what I, that's
vegetables.
What I'm saying. Yeah.
You actually destroy vitamins and vegetables when you're cooking. So maybe we should do the opposite. Maybe we should eat because there's a whole movement going on called the raw food movement where you don't cook anything.
Of course, then you have to be a vegetarian in order.
Well, what about sushi? You see, you don't have to be vegetarian. What about sushi?
Yeah.
You know, you could have that.
Well, I would never think of having sushi, so that would never occur to me.
But how about besides sushi, you could have caviar. See?
Another thing that would never occur to me. So if my diet
steak,
were
steak
a cold tartare, diet, it would
steak
be...
tartare. You could have that too. I think we're getting off
the list. Goes
but
on. Yeah.
The answer is you don't have to have a warm meal to have a good time and healthy food.
If you've got a case that you'd like Judge Zorba to rule on, send it to the show. Just make sure to address your email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some more research coming up, more of your calls coming up, and, of course, our medical myth buster right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. But before our next call, you mentioned, Zorba, a topic on employers charging their workers for health habits. I think this is a really interesting issue.
Oh, it's very interesting, and it's very controversial because you look on one side and you say, is this discrimination? And then you look on the other side and you say, well, take some control of your health. And some people can. They're empowered to do it, and other people are not empowered to do it.
And it isn't just an employee versus employer topic because some employees actually welcome this.
Absolutely. There's some employees, for instance, that say, look, if I slim down and I lose weight and you give me a reduction on my insurance premiums, meaning I get more money in my pocket, I want it because I'm going to work. I'm going to be motivated. If I bring down my blood pressure by taking blood pressure pills so I'm in control, if I go and exercise every day, I get a bonus. I think it's great. And I do, on the whole, think it's a great idea. Yeah. But what about the person who can never lose weight? Yeah. They try and try and try and try and they don't lose weight.
We ought to be clear on exactly what it is we're talking about.
We're talking about if you engage in healthy habits and you reduce your health risks like obesity, like diabetes, if you get your blood sugar under control, can you pay less for your health premium and get more dollars back in your pocket?
Or
the companies will have to pay less money if their employees are healthier.
Yeah, the employer in some instances is charging people more for their health insurance.
And it might be a copay.
If they have bad
habits. That's right. So in other words, let's say your copay for your insurance is $200 a month and you're the right weight, it's $100 a month.
Yeah.
Or it's $200 a month and your blood pressure is under control, well, it's $200, but get it under control, we'll reduce you by $100 a month. In other words, pay for play. We pay you, you play on our side, and you're better. And the fact is, we know that when you give monetary incentives, people are much more likely to follow it.
And this has been tested in court, hasn't it?
It's been tested with smokers. Smokers, you can definitely do it. You can charge smokers more money than non-smokers, and so they pay more. And for smoking, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind. I think if you have a health insurance policy and your employer says, look, we'll give you $500 a year or $250 a year or $1,000 a year more if you don't smoke, that's great. That'll motivate people to quit smoking. What about the person who can't lose weight?
Yeah,
that becomes a different issue. You know, you're 50 pounds overweight and you have to pay more money. 70. But once again, we have to ferret it out as a society. I think, on the whole, taking money, giving it back to consumers who engage in good health habits is good medicine. Will help improve our society, help get people to lose weight, exercise more, quit smoking. Controversy aside, I think it's good public policy.
800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener joins in now in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Zorba.
What's up?
Well, I had back surgery a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And about a month after my back surgery, I started getting this really bad itching sensation on my right forearm. And it never developed into a rash until 6 months later. And the rash went away, went to the doctor. He prescribed me steroids. I decided to not do the steroids and just do topical creams to see if I could just take care of it myself. And the rash went away with Benadryl and some TLC, but the itching sensation is still there. And I just wanted to know, could this be from the chemicals that were used during my surgery? I mean, could this be something that I need to take care of?
Well, itching and rashes are common problems, certainly in family medicine, to see people who have itchy rashes all the time. So I don't think it's necessarily related to that. Have you had eczema in the past when you were younger, food intolerances, anything of that nature?
No. And the funny thing is that after the rash went away, there hasn't been anything. I'll literally scratch and wake myself up in my sleep sometimes.
Oh, well, that's certainly, you know, we don't like to wake up in the sleep. Change in laundry detergent, change in soaps that you're using?
Yeah, I actually went to, like, allergy-reducing, you know, soaps with no chemicals or smell stuff in them. I kind of went to just plain Ivory soap and...
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Some organic laundry detergent.
Uh-huh. So you're still itching at night. That's what's happening?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. How often do you shower? Twice a week, once a week, every day? How often do you shower?
It's about every other day.
Okay, because that's kind of important. What happens is it's the oil in the skin. When we reduce the oil in the skin often, then we develop a rash or we develop an itching with people who have that predisposition. Well, I've got a couple of suggestions. First of all, you want to go to a soapless cleanser, and I would recommend either you go to Cetaphil, C-E-T-A-P-H-I-L, and they have a variety of soaps and lotions. They're safe to use. They're less drying. Ivory that you're using is still going to dry out your skin probably too much. I would go to a point where I would probably shower every third day. You know, if you have odoriferous areas, then you shower those. But we like to shower in our country all the time. Go to France and learn what it is to live in a society where people don't shower as much. They think we're nuts. We think they're nuts. Mm-hmm. And but the fact is, when your skin gets dried out in hot water in the shower, so you want lukewarm shower, not quite as often, a little bit less often. And when you get out of the shower, you may want to cream your body.
So you don't,
and that might be it.
You don't think this is related to the back surgery?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think it's related to that. I mean, you know, by now, because the back surgery was how long ago? At this point?
A year and a half.
Oh, yeah, a year and a half later, it's not going to do it. May do it for a while. I mean, you can have reactions to the chemicals for a while, but not a year and a half later. I think you have a concurrent problem.
Okay.
In other words, it happened here, and I think dryness is the issue. Final thing is humidify the bedroom. Turn on a vaporizer. Ultrasonic is best. Put it in the bedroom. We spend a third of our lives in the bedroom. If the bedroom is dry, you'll itch more. And you're itching, and you're itching at night. And then finally, if that fails, Benadryl, are you taking it in a lotion or are you taking a pill?
I'm using, it's spray, I think.
Okay. Well, it's continue using that. Sometimes the pill will also help decrease the itching at bedtime. So.
Okay.
Good
well,
luck to you.
Thank you so much for
taking
my call.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Indeed it is. 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's get to our medical myth buster now. Today's myth deals with varicose veins. It's long been said, at least it says here, I've never heard of this, that crossing your legs can cause varicose veins. Is that a real risk
factor.
Not in the least.
Yeah,
not in the least.
I've actually heard that.
My mother, who had varicose veins, thought if she crossed the legs, she'd get more varicose veins. And I still remember when I was a kid, all the women on the block would not cross their legs because they thought they would have varicose veins. Yeah, you know, and then there are all the jokes about, you know, keep your legs crossed because it prevents other things from happening in your life besides varicose veins.
What are you referring to?
We'll let our listeners imagine what crossing your legs stops. Well, just leave it to the imagination.
All right, okay.
But getting back to a physical, it runs in families.
Yes.
It's caused by pregnancy. It's also caused by standing up too long. It's very common as you get older. Women are more likely to have it than men, but you can keep your legs open and not crossed if you want to when you're sitting down. It may not be ladylike, though.
So it's okay. In fact, as you, I think, were referencing, sometimes a good idea to keep your legs crossed.
Absolutely. Keep your legs crossed when it's appropriate. That's it. That's my advice from Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Cross your legs when they should be crossed.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust?
That's another myth.
Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. And a caller joins in now in Washington, Missouri. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet. How can we help?
Well, the reason I'm calling today is to get some info on the recreational use of erectile dysfunction drugs, you know, like Cialis, Viagra, Levitra, those types of things.
Are you talking about now for people who are not dysfunctional?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about their use by otherwise healthy men, you know, sometimes as early as their 20s. They're in perfect shape. They work out every day. They have no health problems otherwise, but they swear by the use of ED drugs to go out and, I guess, basically party on weekends.
In order to improve their sexual experiences. And your question is this unhealthy, or is it a moral question, or which?
Well, it's a moral question because it's a prescription drug that's being used for something other than what it's meant for. But is it physically or mentally unhealthy? Because will they come to rely on it either physically or psychologically?
I think that's a good question. Those are good questions.
I think they're all good questions. So the drug, when we look at Viagra and the other Viagra drugs, Levitra and Cialis, they're used and they were developed for erectile dysfunction, for guys who have trouble with getting an erection. If we look at the way they're marketed in the U.S., they can only be marketed for erectile dysfunction because that's what they were approved for. They were not approved for enhancement of erections in men who do not have ED. And it's the same in the EU, European Union. But you look over Asia and how they're used throughout the world, and they're not just used that way. About a third of all the drugs that are sold worldwide are sold to enhance erectile experiences on men who don't have erectile dysfunction, and they're young guys.
Well, when you talk about the marketing, I mean, the marketing is not strictly for dysfunction, even though it's always mentioned in the commercial.
No, the marketing in the U.S. is for erectile dysfunction, but then when you look at the people in the markets, you know, you started out with Bob Dole,
and now you've got 50-something-looking,
absolutely.
Yes, older people, but
that's
pretty
right.
sexy-looking
that's
people
right.
who
that's
are,
right.
you know,
may
looking
may,
to get it
that's
on.
Right. That's yes, right. Yeah. That's right. Now, from a physiological point of view, is there any harm? There is no evidence that you get harm from a physiological point of view. Will they rely on it? Well, that's a good question. I don't know of any study that's looked at whether or not, we'll say, young guys in their 20s and 30s who take it, and if they stop taking it, do they have trouble with erections? Good question. There's no doubt that if you take the ED drugs, you have an erection that may last longer because that's basically how it's used, or may obviate some of the issues with alcohol. Alcohol is the most common drug that is used by people in their 20s, 30s when they want to have sex. They have alcohol, and it reduces inhibition, but it reduces an erection, which is more palpable for guys in their 50s and less palpable for guys in their 20s, and that can be obviated to some extent by Viagra.
Let me put you on the spot here.
Yeah.
Should a physician be
more careful about or less likely to prescribe these drugs to a 21-year-old than a 67-year-old.
Well, and I've had that in my office. I think you have a 21-year-old that comes in and says they're having trouble with erectile function. You have to find out if something else is going on, because that's usually the issue. It may be a family situation. It may be a situation of sexuality or sensuality with the person they're living with. You don't – in a 21-year-old who asks for an erectile dysfunction drug needs a full examination physically and psychologically by a doctor without giving it. But a 50-year-old guy who comes into the office and says they have ED, they need very, very little in terms of it, because it's more common as you get older. Yeah. And it may not be the thing about erectile dysfunction is it's a gradation. It's from 0 to 10, so it's not at any extreme. So does that answer it? Rely on it? Is it an issue? I don't think there's any science out there that tells us, but it's commonly used.
Yes, it is. Thank you very much for your help.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good questions. Important questions to
answer. We appreciate the call. Zorba, on a somewhat related topic, let's grab a question from John in Nelsonville, Wisconsin, before we go. John would like to know if it's unhealthy to continue chewing nicotine gum after you've kicked your smoking habit.
Good question, and I've got a good answer. First of all, about 3-4% of the people who start on the gum continue to chew it either on a regular basis or intermittently for the rest of their lives.
Well, John says like 15 yeah. or 10 or yeah. 15 or yeah. 20 years.
Yeah, many, many, many years. It shows right now, and there have been studies that look at this, that it is extremely safe when you look at it compared to tobacco products, when you look at it compared to snuff or chewing tobacco. It doesn't cause cancer of the gums or the tongue or cancer of the lungs. There's no cancer related to it at all. And more importantly, it doesn't cause disruption of the teeth. In other words, there are issues of whether or not the acid that you produce would actually destroy the dentine over time. It does not do that. Or the dentin over time. I think that's how it's pronounced. I know that the pronunciation police are going to call me on that. I don't know if it's dentin or dentine.
We'll find out.
The teeth. I know how to pronounce teeth. So the answer is it's safer than going back. For some people, it's essential that they have the nicotine replacement, and it's just fine.
We love hearing from you. Just send your questions, comments, and listener tips in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
If you missed anything during the show or want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director, and Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping for your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0922Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.